Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's June 5th, 2024. My name's Eric Osterman. I'll be your host. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse is a DevOps accelerator that helps funded startups and enterprises who are overwhelmed with AWS. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So if you're curious if we can help you out at your organization, why don't you go to cloudposse.com/meet, again, cloudposse.com/meet, to book a meeting with me directly. So how can you maximize today's session? Well, the format's very informal. You can ask as many questions as you'd like. It's great if you jump in and engage on any of the discussions that we have. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools and modules, this is also a great place to ask. And for those of you on the recording, we host these calls live. So you can join us live by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. So I do have one ask. If you do find any portion of today's session valuable, go to YouTube and like it. It helps us get circulation. And also, maybe you can share it with your team if you think they'd benefit too. So thanks a lot. And let's get into some announcements. All right. So I couldn't remember where we left off last week. And I think we ended up kind of talking about everything. But I did want to talk about one in particular. It's actually not a new announcement. It's new for me. So I can't say the number of times at Cloud Posse we implement something and we've pushed it off for so long. We finally get around to doing it. And then like a month or two later, Amazon or GitHub or whatever that thing was that we hacked around ends up adding support for it. This is kind of one of those things. At the end of last year, we decided on a path forward for how we want to improve our reference architecture. One of those things is relying a little bit less on Terraform's remote state and supporting a more pluggable architecture where the remote state could be any number of things. It could be remote state coming from an S3 bucket. It could be coming from SSM or ASM or DynamoDB. You get the point. SSM was going to be our first class supported key value store for that. Problem was, it didn't support reading from remote accounts. You can only read SSM parameters. You can only configure the IAM permissions within the existing AWS account. So Amazon did introduce in February a strategy that enables now through RamShare, the remote access management interface, to share SSM parameters so that you can exactly do what we wanted to do. So make SSM the single source of truth for configuration data by sharing parameters with other accounts that need access rather than manually duplicating and synchronizing data across accounts. So what did we do? We wrote a Lambda that did exactly what this says you had to do. And I guess now it might be not required. Has anybody been using this already? Any other insights?
Haven't used it. Haven't had a chance to check this part out. I did see the announcement, obviously, when we talked about it. But the one thing that I'll point out is I'm not sure that this actually helps with the redundancy scenario, which is one of the main reasons that we were looking at writing that Lambda that syncs everything, because like this is basically RAM sharing it from a single region in a single excuse me, in a single account. If that account or region that is the source has a problem, all of your parameters are still down. And I'm not sure if the RAM share of this allows write permissions from the remote destination.
Do you see that we would need that though?
Of course. Like every account needs to be able to write
To
its own
itself.
local, no, not to itself, to the single source of truth.
I was not looking at it that way, though. Yeah, if there's a single parameter store shared, then like based on key spaces in that parameter store and IAM permissions, then yes, that would be nice. I was still thinking in a decentralized model where every account is updating its own parameters and then exports that through RAM
Oh, I
shares so
see.
any other account can access it.
I see. Interesting. Yeah, so then you would need to know. I don't even know how that would work. I have to look at this. Like, because normally you just refer, I guess the parameter store root would have a different ARM in a
Presumably.
different account. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry, I'm like getting into the
Hey,
details
we're
here,
just
but
making this. Yeah.
yeah.
Anyone have
Yeah,
any
I
experience with the RAM share and Param Store?
We actually just started using it to get data from one account that's useful in another account. The right use case is probably a good one to think about. It's not one that's come up for us yet. And the same thing with the region specificity. We're reading from another account, but the resources that need that information in the other account are in the same region. So a regional outage would affect both accounts equally. We haven't had to do anything cross region and cross account yet.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. Next announcement is this. So the concept is nothing new. If you've been on Linux for, a long time, over the years, you've used tools like expect probably or script. These have been around for decades, and they're a way of automating interaction with terminal apps. They simulate a TTY and can send strings and some of them can wait for responses and so forth. They just feel a little bit anachronistic when you're used to modern interfaces and ways of describing things just using JSON. So HT is billing itself as a headless terminal that essentially achieves something similar. The communication stream, though, is or the transport stream, if you will, is over JSON though. So you send little fragments of JSON to indicate the things you want to do. Why would you want to do something like this? I think their example, if I recall right here, was kind of bad. It was like interacting with an editor. Like, why would you use this to interact with an editor? But other examples are, well, something that we've had to deal with recently is like interacting with, if you want to create demos of some interactive program, you might need to send sequences and record the output. That is one case. If you're working with a another one I've had to do, like I don't know if it's still this way, but like to install Oracle Java, you have to accept the license terms and press yes, and it's a GUI that pops up, and there's no automation flag. At least that's how it used to be. So you would have to script something around that to accept the terms programmatically.
Yeah. Also, like, in back in my like network programming days or networking days, like when you're programming devices that don't have any sort of API, where you have to like issue a sequence of commands to actually get them to do something, you can, and you want it to be consistent, you use like some sort of script like this to make sure that they're done the same way every way, like every time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Actually, it made me think this is like Puppeteer for the command line. If you're familiar with Puppeteer for front ends and scripting sequences for websites, this is doing that for interactive commands.
Yeah, I still don't quite understand why this is better than expect, but okay, I'll accept
Syntax of
it.
expect is from a previous era, if you will. I mean, it's not bad. I just don't like it. It's like, ah, I don't like it. It does the job I don't like. All right. That's it. Basically, your comment though was the gist of it on Hacker News is like, why do we need this? There's already
Yeah, like a 150 bytes of JSON to type y backslash n, like, doesn't make sense to me. Like, that's what I come back to.
Fair point. Okay. Another interesting one. Oopsie, I did not mean to do that. All right. Excuse me. So I thought this was interesting. An attempt at implementing URSA for on-prem clusters. So URSA is something that's used like on EKS clusters to get dynamic short-lived tokens and credentials. Works natively if you're on EKS, not so natively if you have your own cluster managed on bare metal somehow. Now, I haven't read too closely on this. I am assuming it's still getting AWS credentials in your bare metal clusters. And this is a way to get that same interface on those clusters. Now,
yeah, I
there's
mean,
also EKS anywhere you could use, but different.
Yeah, sorry. I was going to say you would have to get AWS credentials because, I mean, URSA is, it's IAM roles for service accounts. That's what URSA is, basically.
But IAM is general. I mean, but it is pretty associated with AWS.
I mean, this is like AWS specific, like IAM, you know, like URSA is AWS specific.
Yeah. As highlighted here, it is specifically for AWS APIs. That said, the same concept could probably apply under different terminology and conventions for other clouds, this one therefore being very AWS specific. And next one was nice little interactive terminal UI for working with JQ. You never get a JQ query right the first time, let's face it. After about 15 minutes of working with ChatGPT and getting going down a lot of false rabbit holes, you start to converge on some query that might work. Rather than using, you know, enter, up arrow, enter, up arrow, enter, up arrow, enter, editing all the time, why don't you just live edit that like a REPL for JQ? So I thought that's kind of cool. Presumably, this would not work so well for streaming data. JQ does, I believe, support streaming data. This is probably taking a snapshot of whatever data is and then filtering on it. Also, it is built in Rust, I believe, and doesn't literally use JQ. It uses a Rust implementation of JQ. All right. Undoubtedly, if you have been poking your head out, you've seen the news about the Snowflake breach, which I clearly linked to the wrong thing. So ignore that. But yeah, so Snowflake, they were breached. Not really a exciting hack. Apparently some malware credential stealer was installed on a support engineer's machine at some point. That credential was leaked. It was sold, I believe, on a marketplace where some hackers picked it up, used it to access the demo accounts. Now, what's really interesting here to me is on Snowflake, they had these demo accounts. And these demo accounts, for understandable reasons, didn't have MFA enabled. I've seen that before. Yeah, I'm sure they're kicking themselves now, but they did not have MFA enabled. But then, how did they transit from some demo accounts to throughout the full organization and then ultimately compromise data by Ticketmaster and presumably many other Snowflake customers? Anyone follow this closer? Let's see, Snowflake. Yeah, this was the link.
The thing that I read said that all of the accounts that were hacked did not have MFA enabled.
But they were demo accounts. So the, and they didn't require MFA. I don't believe that. And I also believe it didn't go through Okta, was somewhere else I read. So that like their usual security controls were just not there. Was it Snowflake? Demo. Thanks. I don't know where I read that. Take it with a grain of salt. I might misrecollect. But yeah. All right. That's all I have on that. Next one. Yes. So this is an interesting one. So in principle, I really like it. The AWS CC provider, it was announced like 3 years ago. It kind of coincided with the release of the AWS Cloud Control API. There was like an internal pact at Amazon that every new service that they release needs to be API first. Cloud Control is that. If you've used AWS APIs under the hood, you'll have seen an evolution. Amazon is the oldest cloud out there. You know, older APIs are inconsistent, and basically every function of the API was manually implemented. Now with the control provider, well, for Terraform, it's programmatically generated from the spec of the AWS Cloud Control API. This is akin to what Pulumi has been doing, so that Pulumi has better feature parity with the API AWS APIs. Terraform can do the same. Now, the reality of what this is doing is a little bit different. At least if people are following HashiCorp's guidance on how to name your Terraform modules, I count 9 Terraform modules using this convention. One by AWS here, another one by AWS, 2 by Hashi Demo Lab, so probably not production. Cloud Freaks has one, great name there. and Tyler Lynch, what do you call it? He works at AWS. He's in the professional services division, and some random one there. Anyways, it's enough to count on 2 hands, and it's not a whopping. My guess is many people maybe using the CC provider are incorrectly using the AWS name for their Terraform modules when it should be AWS CC instead of AWS. Just a theory. Actually, we can probably verify that one pretty easily. What if we do the AWS dash and then AWS CC? Didn't get a huge. Here's an example where this maybe just reading this comments here. It's named AWS VPC, but it's making references to AWS CC. Or they're swapping for, they're moving to. So that's not a good example. Yeah, I don't know. Any insights on this one? Has anybody started using the CC provider? It's been available for years, just not GA. All right. Next. So last week we had a post about how AWS is kind of showing its age. And that kind of also goes with its API. So here's a separate post. I don't think it's by the same person. It just coincidentally came out around the same time, just showing kind of if you've worked with AWS S3, you will cry when you have to implement all the inconsistent ways of interacting with S3, which kind of follows some of the REST API du jour trends and not a consistent interface. Some requests have to go to the regional endpoint. Some requests have to go to a centralized endpoint. Some requests go to your bucket name itself. Sometimes you use query strings and other times you don't. Those are just some of the examples. All right, last two announcements. There's quite a few of these now. This was, I think I saw it on Hacker News, I forget exactly where. It's a curated list of security tools that you can filter and search. That's your area. It's interesting. Without any indicators here of popularity, like Metasploit is obviously a very popular framework, but without some indicator here, I don't find this that relevant. All right. Last announcement I have. I only found out about this and like 2 hours ago when I was on a sales call, and I thought this was interesting. I was speaking to a kindred spirit. They had previously attempted all the things that we've done, deployed their EKS cluster, deployed Carpenter cluster autoscaler, deployed the second generation Actions runner controller by GitHub, and then just along the way ran into every possible problem you can run into. Well, if you're using spot instances, well, you're going to want to make sure to run workloads for your controllers not on those spots so they don't get rescheduled. And if you're using Carpenter, you're going to have to make sure that the consolidation doesn't tear down a bunch of nodes which are actively running your jobs. And yet if you tune that too much, you don't want to have 20 big ass instances running, costing you a lot of money and doing no work. It's a very complicated problem to solve. You have to tweak the configuration of Actions Runner Controller. You got to tweak your Carpenter configuration. And I forget some of the other things that we've had to do along the line. But hey, it's all open source, so it's free, right? Doesn't cost any money to do, except for just a boatload of professional services time or weeks of your engineer's time. So I say all that because they said they could never go back to that. It was too traumatizing. They found runs on, and they're going to stick with runs on. It's a simple cloud formation template that's deployed, runs in your own infrastructure, handles all the scaling, works with Spot, and defines runners that are congruent with the types that are on GitHub's managed service, so the switching effort is minimal. Also, if you've ever gone from on-prem runners, from GitHub runners, there's lots of incongruencies between the images themselves, the tools available, your workflows will probably break. So this is apparently addressing those. Curious, anybody else using runs on, have used it, or have other intel? All right. Well, that's all I got. Any other announcements?
I just thought it'd be interesting to say the Rothrock thing that, or I think was it again? They said Hudson Rock. That article that you linked to got taken down, I believe.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah. So you did actually have a valid link for it, but the legal counsel of Snowflake said no.
Huh.
Just thought you would like to know.
Help me fill this. So wait, Hudson Rock. No, I don't know who Hudson Rock is. It was the link article I had. Are they affiliated in some way with Snowflake or?
This is just me going off of the Hacker News update that I linked in there, and they're saying that it was a cybersecurity firm that reported on this. by talking about the breach to Ticketmaster. And then I guess at that time they didn't realize that it was a part of Snowflake's thing.
Oh, I see.
But from there, I mean, it all goes kind of cold because I guess their Hudson Rock has been told that they were incorrect and that was disinformation. So I thought it would be important to mention that if anybody else had used that that report, make sure to check up on updates, see who's, you know, we're doing finger pointing right now. So I think it
So
needs to be
apparently,
developed.
what we reported on might not be what happened.
Look at
Yeah.
the Reddit that I just that I just posted.
Hudson Rock deletes posts with hacker chats about Snowflake breach. Huh. Oh, this is going to the web archive. So, any was there any more thing to direct my attention to?
It just in there it just says that they essentially got like some sort of cease and desist, so they decided to take down all content related to their report.
Yeah. All right.
And some people are saying that in another thing I read that Snowflake might have paid a ransomware to get all of to get a bunch of things back, and they're now trying to do they're trying to do like media cleanup of what really happened by telling people it was disinformation.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
That's
this makes me recall, isn't there like a whole standard? I think it's like 113 or something like that, for preventing data encryption loss. I know that like things like AWS Vault solve that problem, but there was be interesting if they have picked a particular strategy and that failed them.
yeah. So here's someone's conclusion of the situation. Perhaps
Oh,
a
and we can't see that, by the way. It's still just showing the
oh.
runs on. Yeah.
Oh, oops. I
I'm
didn't realize.
assuming it's musical
Oh,
chairs with
so
web browsers.
yeah, they've been popping up in other windows instead of tabs in Arc here. So you didn't see the other. Yeah, so I had that open, but I also had this open. So this was the wait, what? Oh, yeah, no, here we go. Yeah, so here was the thing that Jeremy White posted, which was about them taking it down. Where was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, previously implied the breach of Ticketmaster and Santander Bank may have stemmed from ac threat actors using Snowflake employee stolen credentials. It has since been taken down, citing a letter it received. And that basically their explanation was incorrect and disinformation. So then looking at this post here on cybersecurity on Reddit, also talking about this point, I thought the final comment here was maybe the best summary of the situation. So there are two data points that Hudson Rock were saying were linked that Snowflake said are not, and they can prove it. A compromised Okta account was used to generate ServiceNow session tokens, and a couple of high-profile Snowflake customers have been breached. Snowflake asserts that the account compromised had no access to production data, and that the customer breaches happened independently and were due to misconfiguration or vulnerabilities in the customer's applications. Given Hudson Rock pulled the article, I'm inclined to believe that Snowflake is correct. So there you have it, both sides of the story. It did seem pretty odd that somebody was able to transit using those demo accounts to other tenants in Snowflake. So this doesn't seem like the full story.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say it's beyond possibility that somebody sends more information than they intend to Snowflake, but I also know that you usually don't do that for very long because it costs a lot of money. So usually you send only exactly what you want to there. But
Yeah. And I mean, Kat posted an update on the this as well. And that was from last week, actually. I didn't see that. All right. Well, that's the end of announcements. If you guys have any announcements, we can talk about those or go into Q&A. Q&A wins. All right. I don't have any questions lined up, so it's a open mic. Anyone?
hey everyone, this is Hao. It's
Hey,
been a
Hong.
while I'll join you guys.
Yeah, good to have you here.
Great. I had a discussion with a community member about NixOS, and I think probably if you like if you're open to new distros, I feel it's a kind of an how to say, it's not cutting edge, but it's a promising technology.
Yeah, I my take on it is like I feel like they missed the boat a little bit. They came out or their popularity started surging a little bit too late after Docker, but it still continues to live on. Matt here and Jeremy Dude both use Nix locally, I believe, and have other more elaborate thoughts on it.
Yeah, it's a big
Yeah,
topic.
my two cents is I'm a geek. I constantly am getting new laptops, and I got really sick of reconfiguring my laptop all the time, and breaking things and installing, the wrong versions of Python for this or I do something with Node and then I broke the system node and all these other things. So I bit the bullet, I guess maybe a little over a year ago now or somewhere around there, and got all my config working with Nix. And for all my development environments, I basically use Durenv and Nix in conjunction with each other to spin up the tools that I need for, for any particular directory I'm working in. And when I get a new laptop, I literally just copy a couple of config files and run my Nix command, and my laptop is fully configured the way I like it, with all the million settings and software and everything else that I have installed on it. So I've been pretty happy with it.
This is like deja vu. I haven't been on this call in about a year, but I think the last time I was on was like the day you set that up, Matt.
Oh, really?
That's pretty funny.
is.
Oscar was asking, I think, Mac OS or Linux, and I actually have a setup for one of each, but my laptop is a Mac, but I have lots of VMs and things I work in that are Linux based, so I have a Nix setup for each one of them.
And I don't use it on virtual machines. I actually have the kind of two laptop setups. So I have Mac OS, and I also have a Framework 13 that I have NixOS on, and it actually has its own little hardware setup for Framework, and you just turn that on, and everything works right down to the fingerprint reader. It's kind of wonderful, in my opinion, to run your host OS on it, but it has, with it, that huge learning curve. I think it's just a sort of a shift in how you think about package management. And yeah, I'd say it was worth it. It was a lot. It was more than I expected, though, coming from CoreOS. So I think I remember CoreOS feeling similar. I can't think of any other distro really that really goes much harder onto the idea of immutable storage.
Yeah, CoreOS was mind warping for me in the beginning.
Yeah, the one thing that I'll just say about it is that I'm, without sounding arrogant, I pick up new technologies very quickly. I've learned new programming languages and been, you know, at least at an advanced, like, intermediate level over the course of weekends and lots of times. And, you know, I have very deep understanding of, computer, like how computer architectures work and enterprise software art patterns and, you know, all kinds of things that you could think of. And Nix is one of the hardest things that I've ever learned and had to grasp. I feel like the learning curve for it was like a 90-degree angle. But once I got it, I got it. It was just really hard for me to understand it all. Like, I'll understand all the concepts and find like good working examples and like working through all the things. But once, like, there was a point that like the light bulb just clicked and then it just worked. But I struggled for like, I think I spent an entire weekend like just trying to figure out how to get basic things up and running. And then I finally, like, maybe 2 or 3 days later after that, it clicked for me and I was like, oh, I got it. But it was just, it was really hard.
I think it was interesting. Mitchell Hashimoto also came out as a big proponent for Nix and using it for local development. He has a post, I think, on his setup too.
Yeah. Also, charm bracelet. If you've looked at their random word generator, it has Nix in it multiple times.
Oh, really?
And Nixos. Yeah. It's pretty funny because I had to compare that with other things. And it's funny what there was several things that were missing. But I wanted to, by the way, somebody was asking in the comments as well. I just thought I would mention this. So when you install Nix on macOS, you can still use your macOS terminal as you've done before. You still have all of your base libraries. It's just that it's creating immutable storage in its own place. And you're just can take your time learning over the next week or so how to create your first sort of Nix package and configuration. And that, you know, you don't have to have your machine not functional for a bit while you're installing it. Or I know that in the past, I think it is true that the M1 and M2 installs weren't as good. They had a lot more problems with, I think, some of the installs, but I haven't had any problems, and I think I'm on an M2. I forget if it's been so long since I've looked at this machine, but it's a ARM Mac.
Yeah, finding all the right channels and everything else is kind of a pain. And then to really set up all the internals of your Mac, you have to also master Home Manager, which is like a plugin for Nix, basically, that lets you set immutable configuration that, you know, on your PC, you run it and it, you know, it will, and it doesn't seem like there's a lot of things that you'd want to do, but like setting your time zone, setting your Wi-Fi network, setting your security, you know, settings, your display settings, like background images, like all sorts of things. Like, think about, you get a brand new laptop, all the stuff that you have to run through to do. And I get brand new laptops pretty frequently just because I'm always giving one to my kid, or I'm pretty abusive to my laptops. I like to stay kind of cutting edge. I just figured, like, I'd figure out once and for all how to script all of that with Nix, and it's it works well, but it was, like I said, real steep learning curve.
Cool. All right, let's switch to any other questions. Any other questions we can get answered?
Something that came up today was around, we basically have some Flink jobs that are running in Kubernetes, and they're essentially like running out of memory and then becoming kind of like zombie pods where they're still like in and out of being like part of the Flink cluster, but they're not able to serve requests. And so apparently the Flink pod definition, like that Flink puts out, has like a liveness probe in there that does a TCP socket check to port 6122. But that's not catching when they go into this zombie state. And so like, there's some discussion around like, how are we going to manage this? Like, because it's a JVM, like, you know, like offering it more memory, like it's the JVM is just going to continue to consume that memory. So like, it may be just like kicking the can down the road, but I was like trying to think of like how we can improve the liveness probe so that it actually can detect when the JVM like kind of goes into this zombie state. So I was curious if anybody has any experience with that or could like point me in a direction.
So what I was wondering is maybe, well, I mean, so I think it makes sense why it's not, the liveness probe isn't working, because the listener doesn't consume any CPU. It's just always going to be bound to that port. It's going to accept the connection. The liveness probe is just doing a basic TCP check. It's going to work, but it's not indicative. Are you in control of the pod spec, of the pod definition? Maybe you can swap it out to use a exec type of liveness probe to run something that actually runs a CLI that actually validates that it's functioning as you'd expect.
Yeah, that's where I was thinking too. I just don't have like a ton of experience of like with JVM specifically, like what would be like a, you know, like if this was like an API, you could just like do it like an API call against it. But like with JVM, I'm not sure what the equivalent thing is that a liveness probe would do.
Yeah, I'm not qualified on that one.
Do you use a Flink operator?
No, we're moving to Flink operator very soon. So that's part of the discussion too, is like, I guess we're like partially, like, I guess it's running in DR, but not in prod yet. So like the other question is like, how much time do we want to spend on this? Cause we're moving to the operator. So I actually haven't played with it yet, but does the operator like handle those situations much better?
Yeah, I feel so. I use a Flink operator. It's easy to deploy, use Helm chart.
Okay.
Yeah, I run into some issues. The infrastructure is not hard to deploy, but so for Flink, you have to write the input and the output. That part will take some time, and also need to figure out the resources you allocate for job. That part is hard.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, it sounds like that's going to be an improvement.
Definitely. There's a different operator. I use the from the community. It works for me, and I also found the operator from Google. It's a deprecated, and there's Shopify version. It's also maintained by Shopify.
Okay. So Google Flink operator.
Yeah, the Shopify one is forked from Google, but that Google one is not used, not developed anymore.
Awesome, cool. I'll take a look at that.
There's another community one I will share in the chat soon. Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you.
No problem. All
right. Just adding really quickly, if you, I'm not sure what your whole setup is, but the kind of canonical way to get all that information out of anything Java is JMX. That's the, Java Management Extensions, I think is what it stands for. And it basically like brings up like a a debugger, not a de- yeah, kind of like a debugger, but it gives you like a way that you can call, like you can use a JMX call on another port, and it will give you like heap size and, you know, all sorts of other stats on the Java process that you're running. So the way that I've seen people handle this before, it's a little bit more complicated than what you're thinking of, but it's like Prometheus, if you're running Prometheus on your cluster, can actually read the JMX, and then you get like all those current stats, and then you can use an autoscaler like Kada or something like that to actually deal with like scaling your pods like in or out as you need to, depending on the total usage of all your heap size and everything. And then you can actually tie that into your liveness probe as well. There's a CLI for reading JMX stuff. So you probably, if you go read on maybe some of those topics, that might point you in the right direction.
Okay, cool. So like basically the liveness could just execute some JMX commands, and if it was like, if the Java process was like deadlocked, it would just time out.
Yeah, or there's that. So JMX is like good enough that it spins up in a separate process. So even if the Java process itself is having a problem, you should be able to actually get a result back from the JMX query, unless literally like all resources are exhausted on your machine. But you should start trending that way, like, as you know, as if you're running that every so often. So set your, you know, set your thresholds to something lower than completely exhausted, and then it should be able to report that pod's not healthy and spin up a new one.
Yeah, because we are getting logs that say out of memory. So I was curious, like, can the liveness probes like read those logs and act on them?
Yeah, a liveness probe can do anything you want if you use the exec type. It literally can run a script that can just read anything. It can run memory commands. It can do whatever you want it to do, and then it just reports like whether it's healthy or not healthy out of that script.
Okay, cool. So yeah, I mean, like having it just act on the out of memory log is probably like the quickest way to just, if it runs out of memory, just kill it.
Yeah. Java, right. Also, just really quickly, Google like Java memory tuning, because that's like Java out of memory is probably like one of the most common things that happens, and because you have to hard set, like you're probably just not allocating enough RAM like to the Java process or something like that as well. So
yeah, well, that was the other thing.
Like an easy one.
Yeah, because that was the first thing I was like, well, you know, we could just increase the resource limits but not the requests, and that way, like, my thinking was the pods, because not all the pods are having this issue. It's just like one job will come through that's like very memory hungry, so increasing, all like doubling the memory across all the pods is a huge amount of additional resources being thrown at this cluster that most of them aren't going to use. And so I was thinking we could just increase the limits, but then I realize that, like, because of the JVM heap size needing to be configured, it's like you basically, there is no like dynamic memory utilization. It's like the JVM is going to consume all of the heap that's there, and so you basically have to give it whatever is available.
Yeah,
tell me if any of that's inaccurate too.
Yeah, what I was getting to just really quickly is that, like, when you run Java, like the, what is it, Java underscore ops, you can set, or you can pass it right on the command line, and it's like XMX, which is like the maximum memory to actually give the heap, and you can actually tell it, and there's some default. I forget, it used to be like, I don't think it's everything that's in the everything that's available in, you know, in the heap. It's basically like 2 gigs or something it's capped at if you don't send it anymore. So the Java virtual machine can run out of memory even if there's memory like left on the even if there's memory left in the pod for it to consume.
Yeah.
So that was my point, is make sure that you're tuning the memory to be like at the same level that you want it to be in the pod. So my Java, I haven't run production Java in like you know, over a decade now at this point. So my memory is like dated on this. So I'm just kind of going from the top of my head. So Tim said he thinks that maybe it's 25% is the max heap size, 25% of available RAM. That very well could be. I just don't remember the number. But look into tweaking that off the top of your head, off the top of my head. That would be the first thing that I would look at.
Yeah. I remember seeing 2 gigs as being the default. I don't know when that may have changed, but either way, I think it's configured to be 2 gigs. And I think what's available is 2 gigs. I was just kind of pointing out that, like, whereas a lot of things that run within Kubernetes could like dynamically scale up to use what's there because of the JVM heap, it's going to basically just like Java's just going to eat whatever heap you give it. So like, you kind of have to give it all that's, you know, that you wanted to use. And then this concept of just one pod out of 20 that actually need the memory is kind of irrelevant because they're all going to eat all of the available memory just because of the way Java works. So anyways, thank you guys.
Yeah. Any other questions? We got about 10 minutes or 8 minutes.
Yeah, let me just quickly say, just for context here, I just looked it up. So on Linux, initial heap size is 2 gig, max heap size is 4 gig by default. So you have to tweak it if you want something other than that. So, done.
Open mic, any questions? Going once, going twice, 3 times. Ah, you're out of here, man. All right, we're ending this. No questions? All right. Well, I'll give you back some time. Thank you all for joining. Great questions, great discussions. We're going to be posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. Find the video, like it, and subscribe. Now, for everyone else who would be interested in maybe working with Cloud Posse, we're a pretty awesome open source company. We do a lot with Kubernetes. We do a lot with Terraform. Maybe go to cloudposse.com/meet and book a meeting with me, cloudposse.com/meet. Finally, we have a few resources or next steps for you. If you want to subscribe to our newsletter, go to newsletter.cloudposse.com. We have our podcast, which is a syndication of this office hours in audio format, so you can listen to it however you listen to podcasts. Go to podcast.cloudposse.com. And lastly, our Slack community. It's at slack.cloudposse.com. See y'all next week. Same time, same place. Adios.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.